Welcome to the Realistic Healthy Living Podcast, where I share with you information that may help and support you as you work towards your own goals. This podcast can help you find a more realistic and practical approach to tackling common dietary challenges. I will be sharing some intimate interviews as well as my own insights to shed light on important nutritional and well-being topics. I'm Shani, your host and a certified nutrition consultant. I work with people seeking to look and feel better, providing them with realistic, safe, and doable solutions so they can reach their nutritional goals without giving up their favorite foods. Ready? So let's begin. Today I'm chatting with James, who is a man in his late 40s that has been struggling with food addiction for a while now. He openly talks about different hurdles in his life and what brought him to where he's at today. James shares with us some of his personal thoughts and life events that you may find very relatable. After my chat with James, I will share some important facts to keep in mind about the subject of food addiction. I will also provide three things that can be done to support a person who has a food addiction. So please have a listen, and I'll see you on the other side. Hello, James, and thank you so much for joining us today. I am super excited to hear what you have to share with us. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the background to what you want to share today.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me be a part of this. We're messaging before this, and the thing that I thought I think would be most relevant, or something that I'm experiencing, is just dealing with addictive eating, especially overeating in my case. I just feel that there's such a lack of knowledge about it, and there's just the things that I have sought out and that I've worked with, and I definitely noticed very quickly how it didn't work. It was Overeaters Anonymous, and it was based on AA, really. Had the same books and everything else. And it felt to me, anyways, that there was a lot of shame brought into it, where you had to stay on this path, and if you strayed from that path, you had your sponsor that you had to speak to and tell them what you did wrong and everything else. And it wasn't a very understanding group, I wouldn't say. There was no compassion, or, hey, you know what, I've been there, I understand, let's get back on the horse. There was, to some extent, some people that maybe had looked a little bit farther past the group, but there was just a very, very strict structure to it. And a big part of it, too, is you basically had to do all this kind of work every single day, like writing down, there's questions you had to answer, and you're expected to do it every day. And then there's calls you had to go on. Then there's the call that you had to have with your sponsor. This was every day. And there was times where I was spending 3 hours a day dealing with this. So I have the time for that, but at the same time, I don't, because I'm trying to do other things. I'm trying to work on my mental health. I'm trying to work on my physical health. I'm trying to take care of all these things. And I've got a lot on my plate right now, especially because I'm currently on disability. I had an accident at work, and it's been a long, hard road. And when you're talking to people and they're saying, well, no, it's just this simple. You cut these things out and you do this or you do that, and then you're going to get on this path, you're going to lose your weight, you're going to feel amazing and everything else. Well, no, there's a lot more to it. Like, they're completely excluding your mental health in that time. There's a reason why we're eating the way we do. It's not just cut and dried and, you know, you got to pray or this or that. The other thing, because that's a lot of it is, from what I was reading in those groups, and I'm not knocking spirituality, because I think a lot of people can find spirituality to help them and motivate them to their goals, but it doesn't work for everybody. It's not a cut and dry path, but they kind of faulted you if you didn't want to follow that path of spirituality that they honestly pushed on you. So there was a lot of things that were, I found, and I don't use this word lightly, but triggering. When you look at the root of what actual triggering is, they ticked off all those boxes, at least for me. It might be great for somebody else, but I grew up with a lot of shame, a lot of, you're not good enough and things like that, unfortunately. And when you're trying to get better and people are telling you you're not good enough still, and you should have shame because of this, well, it becomes a spiral. And if those kind of things trigger you to eat again and overeat especially, then guess what's going to happen? You're just going to be stuck in a spiral. And instead of losing weight, you're probably going to gain weight, because every day you're feeling terrible about yourself because these people are telling you and confirming that you should feel bad about yourself and you should be ashamed. So it wasn't very helpful for me. And like I said, that's my experience. I can't say that it would be bad for the next person, but when you're dealing with other things, like I was dealing with lawyers, dealing with doctors, I'm dealing with physiotherapy, I'm dealing with government bodies that are saying, well, we're going to cut you off. Any financial support you have is gone if you do this or you do that, or if you don't do it. It's there's so many moving parts that it's impossible to just say, okay, well, I'm just going to focus on this, when you're worried about a roof over your head, worried about groceries in your cupboards, you're worried about your vehicle that you're driving, whether you can afford fuel to drive it, whether you can get a gym membership, and then throwing COVID on top of all that. It was a really, really terrible place to be. And it's not shocking that, I gained weight during those times, even though I knew the right things to do. At times it's easier said than done, I guess, is the best way to put it.
So if you can take us back to a time in your life when you are thinking of what started the weight gain, whichever came first, the food addiction or the weight gain, do you remember a time like that?
I think it was when that's a good question, because I think that there's a couple parts to that. One part is the family I come from, almost everybody's big, and it was just normal. And I don't know if I don't know the science of it. I don't know if it's a genetic thing, but it just seemed like at certain ages, we all kind of started gaining a little bit of weight. And it was after graduation where we're, on my own and stuff like that, feeding myself, probably not eating as smart, and probably indulging in a few other things as an 18-year-old. Partying and whatnot, and just not a healthy lifestyle. And honestly, I didn't understand what a healthy lifestyle was back then. I had no clue, because I never really experienced it. I never really heard of it. When I played in high school sports, that's one thing nobody really talked about. We were getting ready for a big football game, and the big thing was we got to go to Boston Pizza and have this huge pasta load. We're going to carb load for the big game and stuff like that. And even when I was in high school wrestling, even though there was times we had to cut weight to actually compete, or else, you're disqualified from the tournament. Nobody talked to us about it. It was very rare. And I can remember going to a camp in Jasper and walking down the street, eating a bag of chips at this, thing with all these high-level athletes and all these high-level coaches and everything else. And the one coach looking at me and, is that really the kind of food you should be eating? And I was like, well, I don't know. But he never expanded on that. He never sat me down and said, hey, if you want to take this serious, there's some things you should probably consider. And at the time, I was so active, I never noticed it. Like through high school, I never really gained weight. I wrestled the same weight all 3 years. The last 2 years I wrestled the same, because the first year I wrestled a weight class that I was at after I was sick and I'd lost like 30 pounds. I was so sick. My first year I was really sick and I lost about 30 pounds, 20 or 30 pounds. Like I was super sick. And when I came back, I was at a really light weight. And the coach said, well, you're going to wrestle this category. So the rest of the year was a struggle. And instead of saying, okay, you know, you need to eat this way, because I didn't understand. I never had that knowledge. It wasn't something from home. We were a prairie family, meat and potatoes and gravy and everything else. And I just thought that was normal. I didn't understand. I never seen it any different at anybody else's house or anything like that. So here I'm supposed to be wrestling this weight class that I'm a growing guy. I was 15 years old. And I'm the kind of guy, if I smell a bakery, I gain weight. So it was a struggle. Instead, we sat in the sauna or we put trash bags on, ran our butts off. So by the time it came to wrestle, we were so exhausted from draining ourselves, dehydrated, everything else, muscle cramps, everything you could think of. But again, nobody sat us down and said, hey, this is the right way. So it's been a tough thing where, and back then I couldn't just Google it. There's no such thing as Google in 1989. So it's been an interesting path because, like I said, once that time was over of high school and, you know, being committed to sports and working out, who knows how many times, you know, hours a day kind of thing, on my own, eating what I wanted, usually carbs and of course beer, that's not gonna, even if it's light beer, it's not gonna work that way. And I noticed that I was putting on weight. I know people made comments about it, and you know, I just would turn to the gym and I would, at the time, grab a Muscle and Fitness or a Flex magazine and see what the bodybuilders were doing because they were all ripped. And I thought, well, if I follow their diets, I'm going to be ripped. It's not how it worked. Nobody explained that different bodies and calorie differences from a 300-pound bodybuilder getting ready for the Mr. Olympia and Joe Blow working at a pipe yard outside of Brooks, Alberta, that there's going to be a big difference. So it was a lot of mistakes. Yeah, and I reached out to people, and the thing about reaching out to people is everybody has what worked for them. It doesn't mean that it's going to be a cut and copy, paste, and you do the same thing. It's not the same. So it's definitely been a struggle for a lot of years.
I think what you're saying is extremely important, and it kind of like surfaces several things. First, the difference between what happened in the 80s and 90s, we didn't have much of the knowledge that we have today. And second is the emphasis on how things are different for every person. Absolutely. If you compete for Mr. Olympia, you have to behave a certain way and follow a very, very strict diet in order to look a certain way and to be able to perform a certain way. But when you are a different type of athlete or you're not an athlete, it takes a whole different thing. And even if you take people in the same group of description, still, because of their genetics and their history and every single bit of aspect of their life will come into play for deciding on what is good for them. So thank you for bringing that up. That is really, really key and something that I would like to emphasize a lot in this podcast. I'm wondering if you could maybe describe, what is the experience that a food addict goes through? What is it that you experience that a person who has no food addiction does not know?
Yeah, that, again, I think is situational. Like different people are going to have different experience than I might. But in my experience, one of the things that I'll give an example is I was going down to Victoria getting treatments, and there were injections, and there was times that I don't know for sure, but I quit counting how many times they would inject me with, it was a saline solution that was supposed to release any of the tension in my injured areas. And I'm talking 30, 40, 50, 60 injections kind of thing, if wow. not more. Like, I swear the one time it was up to 100. And this would be in center of my chest, in my lower back, in my hip flexors, everywhere. And I do mean everywhere. It was very painful. And so then the drive home, dealing with traffic and everything else, it would be almost 2 hours. And I already have anxiety in heavy traffic. So by the time I would hit Duncan, which would be, say, in 45 minutes to an hour from Victoria, I'd be craving sweets. And it wasn't because I needed sweets. I didn't want sweets. But I wanted comfort. And growing up, that's how we comforted ourselves. You know, if there was a family function or anything else, the thing that brought us joy is because we didn't have a lot of money either, but there was that excitement around every year we get to have this particular thing. And it was made to be a big deal because our whole family was like, oh, we're going to get this, and so happy. So now as an adult, I could do those things whenever I want. I had that freedom, which is... it's kind of unfortunate because you do take advantage, or at least I personally was taking advantage of it. So, of course, there was this one coffee shop that I knew if I went there, they had these crazy muffins that were just amazing. And if they didn't have those, they had other ones that were just as good, if not better. So I would end up buying one or two, maybe even three, because I knew the next couple days I could barely walk after these injections. And they were incredibly painful times. And I knew that I needed to soothe myself somehow. Because I'm completely by myself. Like, I'm isolated. There's not like somebody I could talk to and get a hug or, you know, pet a dog. Or, well, I could pet dogs, but, you know, it was hard. So for me, that was part of it. And it didn't matter how much weight I'd lost prior to that. I could have been doing really well and lost 15 pounds. But that one day I was made sure that I was able to have that to comfort myself. And then there's times where it spirals. Well, I did it yesterday. So what's the point about worrying about this week? I'll have it again. Or, you know, I'll have it today and tomorrow will be better. And then something goes wrong and you need that comfort again. So it's a really vicious circle of, you know, like I mentioned earlier, the shame, they're not good enough. And that starts going in your head again. For me, anyway, I shouldn't say it goes because, again, it's situational. It's my experience where all those things, all that negative talk, it just compounds. And all of a sudden you're going to go to the grocery store and you might have good intentions of buying kale and carrots, stuff like that, make some nice soup. And you come back with the kale and the carrots, but there's also a chocolate cream pie and, you know, a couple bags of chips. And you're not worried about the kale and the carrots when you get home. It's the cream pie and stuff like that. So that's how I face it at times. And even if I do some cooking or something, I really like working with a smoker and making whatever, even if it's a smoked turkey or something. I've got good intentions of, okay, well, I've got portions for the next month. If I space it out good enough, I can, every couple of days I can have something. But there's also that time where you grab it and you're tasting it. And like, oh, that was really good. And all of a sudden you're going back. And the next thing you know, you might have had four portions within 2 hours. And you're absolutely stuffed, but you're so amazed by that flavor that you're back. And yeah, like I said, it's situational for everybody, but that's how it shows up for me.
Thank you for being so open and honest about it. I'm sure it's not easy. And I, from reading and learning a little bit about the subject, I think one of the most difficult and challenging things about any kind of food addiction is if you compare it to a drug addiction or alcohol addiction, you don't really need drugs or alcohol, but food we need to survive. So it's not like you can eliminate food from your life and say, okay, I'll just go to a support group and get that food addiction over with. It's impossible, almost, I shouldn't say impossible, but it is so much more challenging because we need to continue and eat food. It's just the management of which foods and also when to stop, which leads me to the question that you have mentioned towards the end of what you just said. Even when you feel full, you still are ready to eat more because of whatever it may be. Can you take us a little bit deeper into that? What goes through your head when you are feeling full and you still want to keep going? Or do you feel full? Is that something that you feel, or the desire to continue eating surpasses that feeling of fullness?
Yeah, that's a good one. I definitely know that there has been times where I absolutely feel full. There's no two ways around it. I feel full. And I don't know what it is that keeps drawing me back. I really don't. I wish I did know that. I wish I did know how to function or how to deal with that. I know that there's been times where, well, it's kind of interesting because I think that if I was actually talking, like, for example, I'm a volunteer with coaching, and I've taken some coaching courses, and I've taken some courses around mental health. And I think if I was talking to somebody and they were saying, you know, they experienced that same thing where they knew they're full, but they just couldn't shut it off, I would ask them about that. Well, what is it about that makes you want to come back? And, you know, work with them on it and see what's coming up for them and how the actual feelings that they get other than hunger. Like, what is it? Are you sad? Is it just a happiness or something? There's usually some sort of emotion that goes around it that we neglect to notice. And the thing about that is it's so easy to talk to somebody else about it. But when I internalize it and because I know that I would, if I was talking to somebody, I would say, okay, well, is there maybe an opportunity for you? Okay, you're stuffed. But you're looking at that, say a nice brisket that you just did or something like whatever food it is you like. And you're saying, I want to go back to that, but you're full. Like almost ready to throw up full. Sorry for the expression, but it's just being honest because sometimes it's like that. And it's, you know, you ask them what it is. Can you take a time where you're feeling like that and the next time it happens to you, you sit back and go, okay, I just want to think about this for a second. And I just want to think am I really full? Am I bored? Maybe I'm just thirsty. Let's have a glass of water first and see how we feel afterwards. Things like that. When it comes to internalizing it, those aren't the thoughts. The last thing I'm thinking is, I shouldn't say, there is times where I will have a glass of water or whatever, but that water doesn't taste as good as that brisket did or the turkey or whatever it was. So I wish I could give you a straight answer about that, what that is and why I don't take that time. But I don't know what that answer is. I really, really don't. And I think you touched on something talking about, you know, drug addiction or alcoholism or whatever it is. addicted to shopping, addicted to sex, addicted to TV, the internet, your phone. People want to say that, well, these are all different things. But like you said, food is a necessity. It's a very, very tricky one that I still struggle with. And I wish I knew the answers. I really do. You know, it's not as simple as just saying, well, I got to look inside myself and find out what it is, because I have spent probably the past 6 years of looking internally, and I feel I've got a pretty good awareness of my emotions, where they come from, but it's still something that's there. It's kind of like that saying on Shrek about the onion and peeling ugly layer after ugly layer. And it is part of it. I mean, the awareness continues, and maybe there will be a time where maybe tomorrow I'll wake up and I have a dream or something, and hey, I know what it is and I can move on from it. But I don't think it's that simple. I wish it was, but I don't think it is.
I wish it was too, but I also want to bring up or reiterate the point that you just mentioned. You know what you need to do, but you don't know how. And I feel the way you started this episode with talking about an organization that may or may not have been helpful throughout your life, I think we need better support in a certain way to teach us the how. We have the capability to understand what we need to do. And you have, knowing a little bit about you, you have done incredible deep work to try and fix things. But it was more about knowing the what to fix than the how, I think. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, that sounds pretty bang on.
I'm sure the listeners can, a lot of their listeners can relate to that and say, wow, I know what to do. I just don't know how.
Yeah.
That's a big thing. I'm wondering if we could talk about a scenario where you are going through what you're going through and you're struggling with your struggles and food is everywhere and people say stuff to you or look at you or kind of like provide a certain energy that makes you feel this way or the other. I'm wondering if you could share with us what those looks or saying or things that come up that triggers or actually help with your situation. Because my goal somehow with this specific episode is to maybe also not only for you to share with such a big and quite common problem that a lot of people have, but also for the people who don't have it, how to behave around people who do have it.
Yeah, that's actually something that's pretty fresh in my mind right now is just a certain person's reaction that I experienced recently. And of course, that was a doctor, a specialist. It really threw me for a spiral. As you can probably hear, I got a little scratch in my throat and I'm probably not talking the best, but because I've been dealing with a sickness and I was really sick for a while. Like I could barely move. I would have to change clothes probably twice a day because I'd sweat through my clothes, and I was in a good area, you know, good place. I was house sitting, so it was a great place to be. But I was constantly sweating, but I was freezing. I had terrible fever, the whole nine yards. So I wasn't able to do as much of my stretching, walking, all the stuff that helps me. I just wasn't able to, because if I tried, it would take me a long time to catch my breath and it wasn't helpful. So I had a specialist appointment, and I've recently was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. So they were talking about the medication and everything else. I had said to them at one point, because it was prescription, 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 of course. And I don't like prescriptions. I don't handle prescriptions very well. Even my family doctor says, we got to work on other things because normal medications, they don't work as well on you. You get really bad side effects. So I'm trying to explain this to this person and they're not hearing it. And I said, well, you know, it seems like all your solutions is prescription. And she goes, well, I'm not trying to push drugs on you, but you're going to need this. You're going to need this. You're going to need this. And she goes, well, you don't have to listen to me, but, you know, you can exercise more. And I said, yes, I realize that. She goes, just because your back hurts doesn't mean you can't walk. And I'm like, okay, yeah, thank you. You're right. But you don't understand the pain I've been going through. And you're not listening to the fact that, you know, I had laryngitis and all this other things. It was ugly is all it was. But just no compassion, no understanding. Just this is how it is for you. And assuming as well. Without asking me questions like, are you doing this? Are you doing that? It was just assumptions of you're not doing enough, which is not helpful by any means. And it's just the negative talk and it's the shame, just like I was saying at the start. All those things that are triggers for me, she was nailing them. And it's very rare to find a doctor that will sit and actually listen to you. Which I was very grateful because yesterday I got a phone call from my doctor. He just returned from holidays and he phoned to check in. And I explained to him what was going on. And he goes, look, I've known you for a long time. He said, I know you're doing your best. He said, but you have all these things stacked against you. He said, we're going to take it easy. Let's just look at the things you can do instead of throwing meds at you. He said, that's the last thing I want to do to you. So it's nice to at least have that person, but it's just such a contradicting thing within that field where it's very, very rare to find somebody like the doctor I have. Because I've heard it all my life too, because I've always been a bigger guy and, you know, they don't want to look at, say, bone density or, the amount of muscle you have or anything else. It's your BMI says that you're this. And then they do the blood work and, you know, I'm saying, well, what kind of things can I do? Well, you know, you shouldn't have any processed foods and stuff like that. I said, I cook all my food at home. Oh, well, you need to exercise more. Well, I'm exercising, you know, up to say, well, at the time, say 10 to 12 hours a week. With everything that I was doing, the doctor looks at my blood work. Well, yeah, I guess your good cholesterol says that you're like it's really high. Like it shows that you're doing a lot of work. Well, why are you throwing all these things at me? You're looking at me and saying, well, this guy is big, but you're not considering the fat percentage I have. Because at the time I was actually in really good shape. But still, he's like, well, because for my height, I'm supposed to be like 140 pounds because I'm a short guy. But I've never been 140 pounds except for grade 8, grade 9 kind of thing. And I know everybody says, oh yeah, big boned, but it's a real thing. It's just such a blanket statement that, okay, you're this, so you need to be this. And they're not looking at the big picture of everything else. You know, especially some of the fields of work I was doing where it was so physical. I was lifting huge things and pushing big things. You're going to naturally gain a lot of muscle, a lot of strength. And a lot of times, the more muscle, the more energy you're exerting, the more you're going to want to eat. And then if something happens, like an injury, you've got that habit of eating that particular way. It doesn't go away because you're still feeding that size. And guess what happens? You start putting on weight. And that's unfortunately one of the things that I've experienced a lot of my life is I would work hard, eating that certain way. And I was always having problems with illness. So all of a sudden I'm sick, I'd miss a couple weeks of work or whatever, or not eating as much. And then when it comes time to heal and you're feeling a little bit better, well, I can't stop eating when I'm coming back from illness or whatever. I'm just like, for example, I was talking to your brother about it earlier today, that ever since I've been feeling better with this cold, I can't eat enough. It's your body just refueling and getting better. It's healing. But for me, I don't like that because I have a negative attachment to it. But it's also a natural thing. Your body needs that. It craves carbohydrates. So it's a vicious circle. It's really hard. And like you said, when going into places and people, and kids especially, they're pointing and looking at you like you're a monster almost. And I don't care, because kids, they're going to do that. They're the most honest beings in the world. They're going to say, oh my God, look at the size of that guy. And I laugh. And the moms are mortified usually. I'm so sorry. He's honest. He's just a child. So that doesn't bother me. It's when you're sitting there with adults and they're having a conversation and, oh my God, you should have seen this fat guy. He was about your size. So they put this negative attachment to this thing and then point at you and say, oh, he was almost as big as you. And you're like, well, I appreciate that. You might as well just compare me to a whale or, you know, a hippopotamus or something like that. That would have probably made me feel better. But you don't need to have this negative with this. And I think a lot of times people are doing it unconsciously. They don't mean to belittle you. But in our society, who gets frowned upon? When you're sitting there, you're listening to comedians or podcasts or anything else, who's the blunt of most jokes? When we're talking about health, who takes the brunt of it? And nobody's listening to their whole story. Because it's not like I wanted to be here and I signed up for a triple XL size body. I didn't sign up for that. If we could break down time in the gym, time dieting and everything else, I would supersede so many people that are in tip-top shape. It's just, it didn't work out in my favor, whether it be genetically or... And I do attach a lot of it to mental health as well. And I think that's one thing that really gets overlooked. And I'll be honest with you, the first person that really did acknowledge that and talk to me in a kind, compassionate way was you. That's the first time and probably the only time I've ever had it attached. Unless talking within, you know, mental health field to people, they have a closer understanding to it where they grasp the differences and the how it relates. So it's a big thing where I could see where people get really upset even when kids are pointing at them, but because it hurts them, because there's that shame and everything attached. Like it seems like that might be the theme of the day is shame, and which shame becomes anger. And that's why you see people react negatively and maybe overreact to even a child.
I think that when we talk about ripple effect or domino effect, the minute that someone triggers shame at someone, if you go through the whole dominoes falling, at the end, that person who suffers from a food addiction will go and eat in order to deal with that shame and everything that happened in between. So that vicious circle or vicious cycle of trying something and then getting the looks or the comments from a doctor or a child or society or a close group of friends that didn't mean to, but they actually said something, it all comes back to us trying to deal with something. And it's not only hard enough to deal with food addictions or dieting or choosing healthy choices or whatever it may be. Not only that, but also we need to deal with reactions from the outside world. And sometimes those reactions actually go against us, which makes it harder. So it is really a vicious cycle. And that leads me to my next question. I'm wondering if there was a perfect scenario of a structure, organization, or a hub, whatever you want to call it, that could support people like that, how would you describe it? What would it provide?
Well, I just want to touch on one thing that you said earlier that I think would tie into this. You mentioned that domino effect, and that person that has that shame goes home and has whatever. It's really interesting how that gets in some ways demonized, but when somebody comes home and has a big glass of mommy juice, and or the dad comes home and pours his Ryan Coke, that's okay. That's normalized. But if I go home and I have a turkey leg or something like that, well, look at the size of you. You shouldn't be having that. It's really funny because it's legal and everything else that's fine. But food is normal. Everybody has food. But a person that has a struggle around it and doesn't understand how to shut that off, they're just a fat, disgusting pig. It's a really, really strange thing. And I think that kind of does tie into what you're saying. If we could realize and normalize, just realize that everybody's going through their own thing. Because not only are there people that are big, but there are people that are a closet alcoholic. There are people that are higher than a kite because they don't know how to handle their emotions. There are people that have anger issues because they don't know other way to deal with it. There are people that are addicted to their phone. Like, how many times do you see somebody that their face is lit up because they're staring at their phone, or they can't wait to get home and watch porn or something along those lines? There's so many different things that people are using as their crutch or using as their escape. That's probably a better way to put it, is their escape from whatever it is that is the demon inside their head. I think if we can come to an understanding that everybody's got their own path, and whatever path they're on, if we can just comfort them whatever way we can and just come from a compassionate place and just not put them down. To just say, hey, is there anything I can do for you? What a strange concept. Is there anything I can do for you? I think that kind of sums up it. I'm trying not to be long-winded again, which is hard, as you can tell.
It's all good.
But I think that's the biggest thing, is just find a place of compassion.
That's really important. And that's, you know, probably true to so many areas. You expressed a scenario when a lady or someone goes home and instead of giving attention to the child, she pours a glass of wine, or the dad would go and pour a glass of different type of alcohol or go smoking or whatever. And it got me thinking that you can see so many people out in the mall, as you said, or just out and about walking, going on with their lives. And visually looking at them, you cannot make any conclusions about their lifestyle, the fact that they are fit or looking slim or walking all high and tall does not mean that they don't have an addiction. However,
and it doesn't mean that they're healthy either.
Absolutely. However, when you have a person who overeats, more often than not, it would show physically. So we are very quick to conclude certain things about someone based on their appearance only, without actually knowing what's going on.
Yeah, no, it's true. Because I have a family member that eats like a horse. And I mean, they're at the age now, you think it would have caught up to them. Instead, they look probably better. You know, it seems like everything's worked out for them. But I remember how their diet was when I did spend a lot of time with them. If I ate like that, I'd be twice my size. But they're a fit, athletic, good shape. Everybody compliments them, you know, for their age, how good they're doing and everything else. So it is one of those things that it's kind of like the Facebook experience and Instagram experience, where everybody has that external thing. They got their pictures of their trips. They got their pictures of their kids, and everybody's smiling and their brand new vehicle and their big expensive house and everything. So on paper, it all looks good, but internally, it could be absolute turmoil. And it's same as our bodies, where, you know, just because a person looks beautiful, everybody stares, doesn't mean they've got the healthiest of habits. It doesn't mean, it's a lot of genetics and everything else, where, you know, if I eat like them, again, I'd be twice my size. But it's so much deeper than than that. You know, everybody has, okay, well, if you do this, this person just lost 72 pounds. Okay. Like my doctor said that to me yesterday too. Just giving me an example. Oh, well, you know, this person did this and they lost 72 pounds. Okay, doc. Well, don't you remember 2 years ago where I was using the same thing and I actually put on 15? Can we kind of relate that? You know,
there's always this notion that weight management is simple. And when people hear, oh, dieting is simple, they immediately translate it into easy. Not at all. Dieting is simple. Yes, you have to do A, B, C, D, but it's not easy because it encompasses so many other factors. It's not about just physiology. It's also about emotions and psychology and your history and your genetics and your everyday choices, your lifestyle, your surroundings, your support system. It's so complex. So is it simple on paper? Yes. Is it easy? Absolutely not.
Yeah, because a lot of people don't think about if you're living in a highly stressed environment, the amount of cortisol that is going through your system. So if you've lived a very traumatized life and things aren't going well for you, then it keeps increasing. It's just making us sicker. And it transforms into different ways, whether it be weight or overeating or alcoholism, or there's so many different ways that it can go. There's too much info out there. And unfortunately, everybody has a different opinion. You can go to 10 different doctors and they're going to say, well, just do this South Beach diet. Well, no, you need keto. Well, actually, you know what? Just you really got to have very little protein and have lots of carbs and lots of good fats. It's just a disaster. Nobody knows what to do. And with social media and the internet, anything you want to find, you can find. And the bad part about that is when you're searching for the stuff you do want, you're finding the stuff that you don't need, that is just making it worse. It's too confusing out here for the majority of people, I think. And especially when you're trying to find a path to be on that you know is going to be successful, it doesn't mean it's going to be successful. I don't know if that means doing blood work. Like, I have done blood tests and stuff like that where they say this diet would be best for you. And when I heard that, I was like, not a chance. I'm not eating that way. And maybe that's my mistake. But I just don't think it's as cut and dry as we wish it was.
You know what? You have nailed it. This is exactly it. It's a trial and error and what is right for you. There's no one fix that fits all, and people are not willing to hear that. So ideally, in my head, in a perfect world, we would have the ability to go to all the professional people and get their information given to us, combined together, so we can know what is proper and good for us. But that does not happen, because who has that money? Well, who has even, that?
Yeah. And even having supportive people around you.
Yeah.
Because you might be doing a certain thing. And I've had this happen to me where, well, you know what? I can't have that. I've noticed that it's affected me. Oh, what's your problem? Are you this? Are you that? And you start getting the shame, and you're experiencing the anger from the person because they're offended. They're feeling shame too, because, well, what's wrong with my cooking? But there's just got to be that acceptance of, hey, I can't have this. Okay, perfect. Is there anything I can put in place? Or do you want to, maybe before you come here, stop at the store, get something you can have? You know, it doesn't have to be a shameful experience.
True. And you've also mentioned the back in the days when we were the hunter-gatherer, people forget that evolution takes time. And over the past 100 years or so, evolution has not caught up, at least in my opinion. Things have shifted so quickly that our body have not had the chance to adjust to the new conditions that surround us.
So if we have broccoli and apples that we want to buy and cost $10, or we can go to a fast food chain and get a whole meal for $10, a lot of people will go to the fast food chain, get the meal, and feel satiated. But in an evolution way, we have not provided our body the ability to accept the fast food. Our body has the ability to accept the apples and broccoli, but not the fast food. So now we're creating stress over our body, which you have mentioned, and you know that cortisol effect, because stress is not just mental, it's also physiological. So when we put stress on our body that is physiological, there is, again, that domino effect that will take us also into emotional and psychological stress. You know, I could go on and on about social media, which I'm a part of. You know, that's a part of my business and a part of my life. But you've said so well that people go and Google stuff. At the end of the day, the way you construct the question in Google is not neutral most of the time. You will also select the questions that reply to what you wanted to hear. And that's a little dangerous.
Yeah.
Right? It could put us in a place where we are taking information that is not good for us, which again, you have said so well. It's trial and error at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's true. Because, I mean, if you Google searched, how can I lose weight eating chocolate, you're probably going to find it. You'll probably find it.
100%. Yeah. Well, James, thank you so, so much. You have shared with us such important information. And thank you for taking the time off your schedule and spending it with me. And
no, it was awesome. It was awesome. I really enjoy chatting with you.
Thank you so, so much. And I'm wishing you the best health.
I personally feel that James brought up so many important points about food and overall behavior around food that many of us can relate to. But what I would like to focus on today is a term that has been used in my conversation with James, and the term is food addiction. To me, it almost sounds like an oxymoron, so to speak, because we must eat. It's not like we can live without food. So definitely incomparable to drugs or alcohol addiction that are not a necessity in our life. So can we actually be addicted to food? To answer this question, I would like to provide a couple pieces of information about addiction. And then at the end, I will provide three ways to support a person as they work on their food addiction. The main thing with people who are addicts is a loss of control over their actions. They will find themselves practically doing anything they can to satisfy their addiction, no matter the cost, even when the price is a loss of friendship or jobs or hurting a family member. And to make things worse, even when we treat our addiction successfully, there's always a chance of a relapse. Sadly, in our society, we tend to judge addicts and think it is a choice that they have made. We think that with willpower and with intent, anyone can stop their addiction, but that is a huge misconception. Addiction can make changes in the brain that are quite difficult to put back to normal. It can be done, absolutely, but it's very difficult. See, our brain works with a reward system. When we do something healthy, like playing sports, for example, the brain will reward us with feeling great, and it will make us want to repeat that behavior. Or in another example, completely different, when we do something dangerous, our brain will have us feel fear so we could stay away from that situation the next time. However, when we are addicted to something, this specific reward system can actually work against us. Our brain will behave as if it was hijacked, and not only it will want more and more of what made us feel a certain way, but it will also make us feel anxiety or stress when we do not get what we're addicted to. Now, you can ask yourself, well, how come I am not addicted to this or the other, but the next person is? Well, we don't really know the answer to that. It can be something in our genes, but we can see families sharing the same genes and one member will be addicted to a substance while the other won't. Generally speaking, we could say that there are some who are more vulnerable to addiction. For example, people who have more of an impulsive personality. Some people have bigger need for friction. And when they don't have that friction, they create situation that will provide them that friction. And that eventually may cause addiction. Also, there are other factors that can come into play. For example, let's take two siblings that grow in the same environment until a certain point, and then one of them experiences something extreme like abuse or really, really extreme stress, which are also common factors in initiating addiction. And these can cause that one sibling to become an addict. At the end of the day, we are all prone to addiction. But a certain event experienced differently by two different people could translate into addiction only in that one person. So that's kind of like the tip of the iceberg about addiction. There is a lot to know, and there is still a lot that we don't know. But we have gathered today to talk about a specific type of addiction, which is food addiction. And I think this is where things get a bit tricky because, as I said before, food is not something that we can choose. It's something that we must have in our life, unlike other substances. Therefore, food addiction most likely would fall under this wide category of eating disorders. There are food addicts that shared with researchers the fact that food can make them feel happy in a similar biological pathway as other addictive substances like tobacco and alcohol. They actually shared with them that they also get a feeling of kind of like a hangover or sleepiness after they have a food binging session. If we go back to the very beginning of what James had shared with us, after I asked him if he could pinpoint the time when he thinks his food addiction began, he brought up something that is actually being studied to better understand the concept of food addiction, and that is the feeling of vulnerability. It seems like it takes a certain vulnerable situation or a series of those in a certain time of our lives where our brain sends us messages that the food we just ate calms us down and gives us a good feeling that we will want more of and repeat over and over again. And those specific foods are normally, in most cases, are highly palatable foods. Meaning, if we experience a certain situation that makes us sad, angry, disappointed, hurt, or any other vulnerable sensation, if right after that or during that we turn to foods like sweets or salty snacks such as chocolate and cookies and ice cream and chips, we will get a feeling of reward that will make us reach out for that food again to experience that good feeling these foods had created. Because now we attached a certain taste to a certain feeling, and that was carved in our brain as a good feeling that we will want to repeat over and over again. A big part of it is good old dopamine. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter, which is a molecule that makes a connection between two nerves. dopamine is known to be the feel-good molecule or the motivation molecule, but it is also known as the molecule of more. Now, because dopamine will be released when something feels good alongside other transmitters, it will make us want to go back and repeat that behavior. Now, addiction is probably not something we can completely cure, but it can be managed. It can be better controlled. I'm not a qualified professional to help with addiction. My input is only of nutritional information and healthy living guidance that may help and support a psychological or psychiatric treatment while working on addiction with a designated professional. So what I'm going to do is provide three tips to help out a person that is working with an addiction professional. My first one would be nutritional behavior, and I specifically chose nutritional behavior as opposed to the foods we eat because nutrition is not just what you choose to eat, but also a way of thinking and behavior around, alongside, and with food. Now, this may be different from one person to another, but creating a baseline would be important. Assuming the food addiction is translated mostly through eating foods that are highly palatable, which, of course, are normally high in sugar and salts, and sometimes fat too, it would be a good idea to put an emphasis on getting a variety of wholesome foods to ensure our body is not lacking any nutrients. That would mean getting all the macronutrients in the right ratio for the person, as well as all the vitamins and minerals to support a healthy environment. In addition, being properly hydrated can assist as well. The second thing to try and do would be physical activity. What I mean by keeping active is following a certain activity that will allow the person struggling with addiction to get that release of endorphins, which are not only known as natural painkillers, but also help with good mood. Common physical activities that release endorphins alongside dopamine and serotonin, which are all under the umbrella of happy hormones, are exercise, sex, dancing, and laughing. Some people find that meditation also is something that can help with releasing endorphins, and others can find that spending time outside can do that. A well-studied endorphin releaser is safe exposure to sunlight during the day. Sunshine makes us happy. A third way that I would like to suggest when supporting an addiction treatment would be helping someone else in a certain way on a regular basis. For example, volunteering or sharing your own experience with people who struggle with the same thing. Helping a person in need or saving a pet from a bad condition. When we do something for someone else, it makes us feel good. And again, it releases those happy hormones we just talked about. This concept of creating that good feeling in our brain and in our body can help us rewire our brain to feel good without anything to do with food. And by doing so, we can actually seek other sources of happiness that will take us away from seeking them from food. So to sum up, when we experience an overload of pleasure from the foods we eat, or any other activity for that matter, that repeats itself over and over again, our body will eventually get used to these levels and then we'll find ourselves needing more in order to get the same amount of pleasure. Now, as pleasure and pain are interrelated, according to Dr. Anna Lamke, a psychiatrist from Stanford University, the overload of pleasure then turned into overload of pain is where we need to pay attention to.
I hope this episode provided you with some value. If so, your support will really help me. Here are two simple ways to do so. The ideal and easiest way would be to click the follow sign. And if you're willing, please share my podcast with anyone you think could benefit from it. Thank you for joining me today, and I'll see you in the next episode.